and thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub Online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from God Awful Gaming by No Illusions. It was first broadcast live on Thursday, 27th March, 2025. The video of this and many other recordings are available at sitp.online. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you'd like to support what we do, you can subscribe to our Patreon, Skeptics in the Pub Online.
All right, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here. I'm really excited to give this talk again, because it allows me to sort of meld together two of my loves. If you're familiar with my work, you know that I love consuming terrible Christian media. I have a podcast called God Awful Movies, where we review a new Christian movie every week. I've been doing that for almost 500. I think we're having our 500th episode next week. So I get quite a bit of that. But we also have a show called The Scathing Atheist, where we very often read Christian books, read Christian comics, listen to Christian music, watch Christian videos. So I know quite a bit about the Christian media. And I do that for two reasons. One is that I think it's important that somebody in the secular world is consuming this stuff, seeing what messages are being disseminated by it and reporting back to the larger community. The other is just sort of a staring at the train wreck thing, right? It's just kind of fun to watch something that is as terrible as Christian media tends to be. And of course, included in that media is Christian video games. And that's a special a love of mine, because I am also a huge fan of video game history. I'm what you would call a retro gamer. That's the term for a person who loves video games but hasn't bothered to get good at a new one since 1994. So I'm also an avid reader about video game history and an avid collector of vintage video games. So I am going to try, as I promised Gerald and the folks before we started, I'm going to try not to chase every little rabbit down every little hole that's going to tempt me as we go through this history. But I am going to talk you through the history of Christian video games. And along the way, we're going to answer a few very important questions. Most notably, why do Christian video games suck so bad, right? And why do Christian video games continue to exist if they suck so bad? So to understand that, we have to go all the way to the beginning of the video game, the history of the video game industry. That starts in 1972. The history of video games, of course, is older, but the industry begins in 1972. The very first time a person could go and put a coin into a machine and play a video game because of that was in 1972, a company, a not well-known company called Nutting Associates. Nutting is a guy's name, and a different thing back then. It's a different kind of video game than you're thinking. So 1972, a company called Nutting Associates comes out with a video game called Computer Space that has a very sexy cabinet. You may have seen this cabinet if you ever watched the movie Soylent Green. It's featured prominently on that. If you watch Jaws enough and you really pay attention to the background, you might have seen it there. Where you wouldn't have seen it, though, was like in a bar or arcade or restaurant making a lot of money. It was not a very popular game. It was confusing. It just didn't have an analog. People didn't know what they were seeing when they saw it. So Nutting Associates decided this video game thing was a dead end. They got out of the business altogether. But the guy who spearheaded the Computer Space program in 1973, he leaves the company to form his own company. He's a guy by the name of Nolan Bushnell, and the company he forms is called Atari. Now, that's a company you may have heard of. 1973, they released a video game called Pong, and that's the game that really birthed the video game industry. It was an enormous hit. There were a bazillion clones of it, and video games have been a big part of our lives ever since. Now, to understand the history of Christian video games and the larger history of video games, you have to understand that when video games were born, they were born with a bad reputation, right? For a couple of different reasons. One is that they were heavily associated with gambling. People had seen a coin-operated game where sometimes you win and sometimes you lose before, right? This wasn't unique. And when they'd seen that in the past, it was a form of gambling. So they were convinced that this was a gambling machine. And even if you could convince them it wasn't, they would tell you, well, you're priming people for gambling. And even children, right? Because kids play this thing. So you're priming children for gambling. That's bad. Another reason that video games were distrusted right away is that they were associated with organized crime. This was simply because they were coin-operated. Everything that was coin-operated was associated with organized crime at the time. Coin-operated machines are a great way to launder money. I'm not offering advice. I'm doing a history here. Don't get any ideas. So if you watch old sitcoms from the 70s and 80s, old American sitcoms, you'll actually catch references very often to the idea that all pinball machines, all jukeboxes, et cetera, are owned by the mob. And speaking of pinball, that's the other reason why video games were so frowned upon early in life. They were associated with pinball, which was considered to be quite sinful. I mean, just look at it. Tempting the kids with its salacious bumpers and whatnot. This seems so silly to us now that video, that pinball would be seen as a sinful activity because it's so abstract. It's just a metal ball rolling around on a board, right? But it was seen as an idle thing. It was seen as like tempting kids into whatever, whatever. The real reason that pinball was frowned on is because of classism. Right. It was one of those things where if you were a rich kid or a poor kid, it didn't matter. You went to the same place. You went to the same pinball parlor if you wanted to play pinball. And anywhere where the classes had to mix was seen as a low activity by the upper class, by the middle and upper classes. So video games have this terrible reputation because of the gambling, the organized crime, the association with pinball, all of these things. So it should come as no surprise that the first moral panic that happens around video games doesn't take long. The industry, for all intents and purposes, starts in 1973 with the release of Pong. By 1976, you already have your first moral panic. And this is where the Christian influence on the larger history of video game begins, right? Because it's this Christian sensibility that causes this this panic. The panic it revolves around a game called Death Race. This is a game that was made by a relatively small video game company called Exidy Games. And you can see this is the artwork that you would see on the game in if you walked in and you looked at the cabinet in the arcade. And you can see right away that this is something that's going to scare Christians, right? There's skulls and there's crosses in the back. Yes, they're tombstones, but they're crosses. There's a cross as the T in Death Race and the bones. And it just looks sacrilegious to them. Now, I would love to tell you that the freak out about violence in video games had to wait to exist until video game graphics were better than this. But no, these were the graphics for Death Race. The little gray thing that you see there, that's supposed to be a car, right? So you play as the car, you drive around, and you're supposed to run over these little white stick figures. And when you run over one correctly, it becomes a cross. It becomes a headstone. And now you've got to avoid the headstones while you run over more of the little white stick men. And the little white stick men scream when you run over them. So, like, you know, predictably, the prudes in America freaked out and they protested about this. This is a more modern protest. I couldn't find a picture of the protest at the time. I think this sign is right, though. I think God does hate game designers if you look at the layoffs and the crunch time kind of stuff that they have to deal with. Well, anyway, so from a modern lens, it would be easy to sit here and think, oh, hey, well, great for Exidy Games, right? They've created this this controversy. Now people are talking about their game. No such thing as bad press and all that. That really wasn't the way it was back then, though. We're talking about a time when a concerted effort by a parents group could get a television show shut down, right? That still happened. So when video games makers saw people protesting Death Race, they saw it as an existential threat. So instead of defending their industry, they actually jumped over on the other side of the protest line, right, and started protesting Exidy along with the parents. And they said, yes, we video game manufacturers are also disgusted by Exidy. Nolan Bushnell, the most visible person in the burgeoning video game industry, comes out and says, yes, the Exidy's crossed the line. We here at Atari would never make a video game where the point of the game was to harm another human being like they did. Don't look at that. Don't pay attention to that. But this is the first big change that Christianity makes to video games, right? Because after this, after 1976, you see this clear trend towards cartoonification within video games, right? Keeping in mind that when Pong was first released, it was released into bars. It was expected to sit alongside pinball machines and dartboards and billiards to be one of those skill type games. But now it's being cartoonified to keep parents happy, right? To keep angry Christian moms and dads happy. And so it becomes this cartoonish thing, because who can complain about the violence in video games when that violence is being perpetrated by a walking or against a walking sausage, right? So, and this is a lasting effect that Christianity has had on video games. I would say that even today, video games are seen inordinately as a childish thing because of that. And if you don't believe me, try taking video game history seriously in any conversation. So up until this point, video game history is playing out in two venues. You've got the arcades, and you've got video game consoles. From the very beginning, 1973, the same year that saw Pong, also saw the release of the first video game console. You'll see it right there. It's the one on the bottom left there called the Magnavox Odyssey. But these consoles are what's called Generation 1 consoles or dedicated consoles. What that means, in contrast to the type of video game consoles we have today, is that these weren't programmable. You couldn't go out and buy another cartridge or another disc or download a new game for them. Whatever games they played, they played. They were programmed into the system to begin with. If you wanted to play another game, you had to buy another console. Now, what that meant in practical terms was that the video game industry had to shoot for the broadest possible group of people, right? The broadest possible audience, because you're trying to appeal to anybody that walks into the arcade or anybody that walks into the Sears, right? The cost of bringing a video game cabinet or a video game console to market was too great for you to aim it at a niche audience. Now, this idea that they should go for the biggest possible audience, they didn't actually do that, right? The video game industry didn't discover girls until 1996 or something, right? But that was the goal. The point being that there was no room for Christian video games at this point. Now, that would change in 1977 with the advent of the home computer revolution. As a bit of an antiquated term there, home computer. We that's what we called them back then, right? Because computers lived in the office. So we were distinguishing between an office computer and a home computer rather than like a laptop and a desktop. So the home computers, now this is the point, I know I'm giving this to a largely British audience. This is the point where I should have some Uncle Clive jokes, but I don't. I'm an American. So we didn't have the ZX Spectrum back then. Instead, we had this bad boy here. We had the TRS-80. This is our equivalent to the ZX Spectrum. The TRS stands for Tandy Radio Shack. Tandy is a company that made them. Radio Shack was the place where you go to buy them. The 80 is a reference to the Zilog 80 processor, the microprocessor that it used, but really it was just a number for numbers' sake. They like to put numbers at the end of computers back then to make them sound more legit, you know, like HAL 9000 or R2-D2. No, I don't know if you guys can read the copy, because this isn't the best graphic that I sent over to these guys. But I want to highlight one part of this copy. This is amazing, right? So this is this system came with 4K of read-write memory. That's K, 4K. Don't worry, though, you can upgrade it to 62K if you pay more. Yo, this thing costs $600 in 1977. That would be the equivalent of 2,300 pounds in today's money, or $3,100 for the Americans watching along. It's unbelievable for this piece of junk. And it was bad even by the standards of the day. If you used one back then, you probably didn't call it the TRS-80. You knew it by the same name everybody else who used it knew it by, the Trash-80. It was just this absolute piece of junk, this garbage amalgamation of compromise. And fittingly, it was the birthplace of the Christian video game industry. That would happen in 1982. I should have an asterisk on that slide, though. I have to admit here, and again, try not to chase every rabbit down every hole here, but I have to admit that between about 1977 and really about 1984, 85, there's a bit of a black hole in the history of computer games. Most games that were sold for home computers in that period were sold by homebrew companies, by which I mean like, you know, some guy or gal in their bedroom programming on a Trash 80 and then just copying things to disk or cassette or whatever, and then selling it, you know, with a photocopied instructions at the local computer store. That's how most of the video games, not the most of the units, but most of the individual video games were sold back then. And so almost all of those are lost to history. The majority of games that were sold for home computers between 1977 and 1982 are probably unknown to history. It is almost certain that there was a Christian video game at some point in that period that we don't know about, right? The earliest one we know about is 1982. That's a game called Bible Bytes. It was actually a series of games, what would we call mini games now, what we called games back then. You had games like Noah's Ark, because, you know, what a great premise for a game, the genocide of the entire world. There's the unfortunately titled Moses's Rod. They had a Sermon on the Mount video game, because how could you go wrong with a video game about the Sermon on the Mount? So these are the first Christian video games that we know of at all. They were sold for the Trash 80. You could buy them on cassette. Again, they didn't have disc drives for the Trash 80 yet. Or you could buy books that had like the source code. Yeah, they actually had the basic code that you could type into your Trash 80, pages and pages of basic code to play the Sermon on the Mount video game. So those were the first PC games that could be considered Christian games. The first console games would come a year later. That's 1983. The console in question is the Atari 2600. There's another number that doesn't mean a damn thing. That was a reference to an internal part number in their warehouse, the Atari 2600. It was originally sold as the Atari VCS. This was the dominant console of its generation, and that generation would be the second generation. This is the first generation of programmable consoles where you actually could change the game. And that was a huge, it was a game changer, quite literally. But it was also a problem. It was a huge problem, ultimately. The problem was third-party software. So what happened is a bunch of the Atari programmers got together and they said, hey, we're programming these games that Atari's selling. They're making millions off the games we're selling, and we're making, 25 grand a year or whatever they made back then. And that sucks. So why don't we just start our own company making video games for the Atari VCS and just keep all the money? And so they did. They created a company called Activision. It was the first third-party software company, I believe, in the world. It was certainly the first third-party video game maker. It's a company that's still around to this day, for better or worse. And they would go on to make some of the best video games ever released for the Atari VCS. But when they swung the door open to third-party software, they swung it open for everybody. The courts ruled that this was, Atari sued the programmers that started Activision, but the courts ruled, no, they can do this. And so what happened is there became this glut of terrible games on the market. It became impossible for the average consumer to go into a store and buy a video game for their Atari that didn't suck. Right? There's just too much choice. There were also a bazillion different consoles at that point, and a lot of people would buy the wrong, get games for the wrong console. They didn't understand that you needed... that only Atari games would play on an Atari console. So all of this together would lead to the the video game crash of 1983. This should be called the American home console crash of 1983, but it's a big part of video game history. And it, of course, is in amongst this glut of terrible games that we find the first Christian console games. The first of those is a game called The Music Machine. It's not like explicitly Christian. The instructions make it clear that it is a Christian game, but it's just, you're just moving along the bottom of the screen. You're holding this little basket. You're trying to capture the things that follow the Christian symbols, like the dove and the angel and the sheep or whatever, the lamb, that are falling down. You're trying to catch them. This is a very common form of video game, very, very generic video game at the time. So, as I said, the instructions made it very clear that they meant for this to be a Christian game. The other game that came out in the same year, a little later in the same year, was a little more explicitly biblical. It was called Red Sea Crossing, where you played as Moses. Apparently God parted the Red Sea, but he didn't want to make it too easy, so he left you some clams to fight along the way. So that's the second console games, Christian console game, the only known Christian console games for the Atari 2600, Music Machine, and Red Sea Crossing. And those two games, by the way, are amongst the most valuable collector's games amongst vintage game collectors like myself. The Music Machine, the last time it sold at auction, it went for $5,000. Red Sea Crossing went for even more. The last time that one sold at auction, it was $10,700. $10,000, and that was in 2017. Vintage game collection collecting, I believe it was 2017. But the point is that if it sold today, vintage game collecting is much bigger today. It would sell for easily twice that, probably three times that. Now, this is not because a bunch of people have fond memories of playing Red Sea Crossing and fighting the clams as Moses is. It's because nobody has memories of doing that. Nobody remembers these games. Quite literally, when Red Sea Crossing first resurfaced at an estate sale, there was a lot of arguments on the Atari collectors forums about whether it was legitimate, whether it was real, because there was no record of its existence. It took, I think, over a year for somebody to track down the single ad that ran once in Christianity Today magazine selling that game by mail order. There are only two copies known to exist anywhere in the world of that game. And so I want you to put a pin in that, the idea of people paying an absurd amount of money for Christian video games that nobody wants to play, because that's a theme later on in the talk. But before we get back to that, I want to move off the shores of my native United States of America, because, of course, in the late 70s, early 80s, there was another major national player in video game history. That was, of course, Japan. And specifically at this point, Nintendo, there were a lot of Taiko and Namco. There were a lot of Japanese companies that were doing huge work early on in video games. But of course, the most important as the 80s rolled on would be Nintendo. And a lot of the reason for that is Nintendo had a guy working for him by the name of Shigeru Miyamoto. Still does. He still works for him. He still does amazing work. If you were to carve the Mount Rushmore of video game history, I don't know how American that reference is. If you're going to count carve the galley of the great video game history, figures in video game history, right? The first statue you carve is Shigeru Miyamoto. This is the guy who started his video game design career by making Donkey Kong. If that is the only thing that he ever did, he'd already have earned his way into the annals of video game history, but he would go on to also create the Super Mario franchise, as well as the greatest video game franchise of all time, The Legend of Zelda. He has a bunch of other games, a bunch of other great games under his belt. But also, like, more than that, he was one of the early people to fully see what a video game could be, right? His game, Donkey Kong, was the first game that had, like, a beginning and an end. It was the first game that told a full story, right? So you could say that Shigeru Miyamoto created video game narrative. And even if you don't want to give him that, you have to at least admit that he created the fucking jump button, and that's a pretty big deal, right? So Shigeru Miyamoto was already a superstar by the mid-80s of video game design. He had created Donkey Kong, which was incredibly successful, really put Nintendo on the map. He already also had a Popeye game at this point that was becoming very popular. So his bosses at Nintendo, they turned to Shigeru Miyamoto and they said, we want you to make another game that's going to be popular in America. And what was America's video game obsession in the mid-80s? Why, that would be Pac-Man. And was huge back then. He was on the radio. He was on the towels. He was on the cartoons. He was in your breakfast cereal. Pac-Man was everywhere. Americans love Pac-Man. In fact, it spawned a whole genre. There was back then we talked about maze games as a genre. It's not so much anymore. But there were a bunch of different Pac-Man-like games. And Nintendo wanted one of their own. So they turned to their very best designer, Shigeru Miyamoto. They said, make a game like Pac-Man that the Americans are going to eat up. So the first thing you need at that point, right, is you need a cute cartoon character at the center of it, but, for the reasons that we've already discussed, but also so that you can market it later. That was another big thing that Pac-Man taught everybody, is that if you had an acute character at the center of the whole thing, you could make more money selling the toys than you made with the video game. So they came up with this cutesy little dragon with cutesy little boots on. So he's got to run around a maze. And while he's running around a maze, he's got to collect something, right? That's the whole point of the game. Well, you can't do dots. That's already been done. What do Americans love? What would be the thing that Americans would want to collect in a video game? Bibles. Obviously, they love those things. Bibles. And of course, you need something else. So how about, hey, crosses. They wear them around their necks. Americans love Bibles. They love crosses. So he'll run around his maze. He'll collect his crosses. He'll collect his. But he needs a bad guy, right? Every antagonist or every protagonist needs an antagonist, right? So who's the bad guy according to Americans? Why, Satan, the Prince of Darkness. So a little cute dragon. He'll run around and collect his Bibles and his crosses, and he'll fight the devil. This is a real game I'm talking about. It's a game called Devil's World. It's actually a fantastic game, but it was not particularly well known in the United States because it was never released in the United States. Nintendo America saw this game and they said, what are you kidding me? No, you can't release that game. And Nintendo of Japan was like, why not? Americans love Bibles. They love crosses. They hate the devil. They're like, no, but this is sacrilegious. This is blasphemy. To which the Japanese businessmen said, well, explain that. Where is the line between being reverent to their religion and being blasphemous? right? Because this is exactly the kind of thing that Japan would do for their own native religions, right? Have some fun with it. Well, Nintendo America looks at this question and their jaws hit the floor. And look, I do this shit for a living. I am a professional blasphemer as much as one exists in the world. And I could not tell you where that line is, right? If you're a Japanese businessman that has limited familiarity with American culture. So Nintendo says, well, hey, look, we'll just, from now on, no religion in our games at all. We don't understand their culture. We'll fuck it up. We'll put an enormous amount of money into a game meant for an American audience that we can't sell to an American audience again. So no more religion in our games. Now, that would be a fairly minor note in the larger history of video games, except that in 1986, in the post-home console crash America, Nintendo would absolutely take over the video game industry with their Generation 3 console, the Nintendo Entertainment System, or the NES. Now, the NES was designed to circumvent the big problem that took down the Atari VCS. That was the bad third-party software problem, right? So when they released the NES into the American market, they did so with a thing called the Nintendo Official Seal of Quality. And if a game did not have that official seal of quality, it couldn't play on the NES. And the only way to get that seal of quality was to submit your game to Nintendo and have them check off that, yes, the game works. Yes, the game is long enough. It's fun enough. But also that it meets all these moral criteria. Right, or criteria, rather. Like, it's got to be, no nudity, no sex, no violence, no excessive violence, where they had limits for their violence. They had rules against cigarettes and alcohol, and they had rules against religion. Now, if you played NES back in the day, you probably are immediately populating counterexamples in your mind. You're thinking, oh, well, you know, Castlevania had a lot of religious symbolism. Metal Gear had cigarette smoking in it. You know, like there were a couple of places where those rules got violated. But generally, Nintendo was very strict about that. I'll give you a great story, a great example of just how strict they were. There was a game, I believe it was Konami, made a game based on the cartoon DuckTales. It was very popular in the early 90s. And they released it in the UK, and it was very popular there, and then they wanted to release it in the US. Of course, differing TV standards, the PAL versus the NSTC. I think I have that right. Anyway, so the differing standards meant that they had to localize it, even though it was already in English. And Nintendo said, hey, while you're in there localizing it, you also have to take the religion out. They said, there's no religion in this game. And they said, no, there is. In the morgue stage, there are coffins, and on those coffins, there are crosses. You have to take those out for the American audience. And they did, right? They did. They took the crosses out. That's how much Nintendo was bending over backwards not to offend Christians. Now, Christians hear about this incredible effort that they're undertaking not to piss them off. And of course, they label it persecution. Because they label everything persecution. See, Nintendo thought they were doing the right thing, but while Christians would agree that putting crosses into video games is sacrilegious and blasphemous, taking crosses out of video games is even more sacrilegious and blasphemous, right? So they demanded the crosses be put back in their damn games. Not only that, but they wanted games that were explicitly Christian. Games that they could feel good about giving to their kids that wouldn't challenge any of their Christian beliefs. Well, Nintendo held strong on this. But another company was happy to step in to fill that void. That was a company called Wisdom Tree Games. And Wisdom Tree Games was a subsidiary of a company called Color Dreams. And Color Dreams had already figured out a way to thwart Nintendo. So Color Dreams, they were not a very well-known company at the time, but they already existed prior to this. They were best known for a game called Menace Beach. This was a generic beat 'em up where you're running around fighting these gang members that had kidnapped your girlfriend. That was the plot of one out of every three games back then, at least. And so the game was too generic to be remembered for any of its gameplay. What it was remembered for was a slight amount of controversy about its cutscenes. The scenes between levels, you would see your girlfriend chained to a wall and she'd be angry at you for not saving her yet. And each progressive stage, her clothes would have rotted off a little bit more. Right. So that's the Christian values of the company that decided to step in and make Christian video games for the Nintendo Entertainment System. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, but Noah, you just said you had to have the Nintendo Seal of Quality and that these guys couldn't get that Nintendo Seal of Quality. So what gives? Well, there were two different ways that Nintendo enforced their Seal of Quality. The first was a system called the NES 10 lockout chip or the CIC lockout chip. Basically, this was a digital lock and your game had to have a digital key that was only provided by Nintendo once they approved your game, right? So this was, and a bunch of people tried to thwart this, and there's some really funny stories about all the different things that that they did. But ultimately, the simplest solution was the one that Color Dreams came up with, which was just to send a 5-volt jolt to the microprocessor that handled, there was like a separate microprocessor that handled the NES 10 lockout chip, and they would just short it out while it was trying to check for the digital key, and the system would just boot up. So, but that was the easy part, right? That was the easy part to get around. The hard part was to get around Nintendo's lawyers. And enjoy that slide, because they're going to sue me for it eventually. That's how litigious these guys are. And what Nintendo's lawyers did is that they worked, because they, you know, you can't legally enforce the Nintendo Seal of Quality, right? The courts had already ruled for Activision that third-party software was perfectly legal. But what Nintendo's lawyers could do was they could enforce a clause in their vendor's contract that said, if you sell a game that plays on our system that doesn't carry the Nintendo Seal of Quality, you will lose your license to carry Nintendo products. Which in the United States in the 1980s, if you lost your license to carry Nintendo products and you wanted to sell stuff to American families, you were out of business. It was not that bad in Europe. There was far more PC gaming in Europe at the time. But in America, Nintendo absolutely owned the market from about 1986 to about 1994, really. But luckily for Wisdom Tree Games, that only counted in the real world. And America has an imaginary world that has been laid over top of the real world that I call the Jesusverse. It's this world that Christian parents create so as to never have to acknowledge to their children that the real world truly exists. And the Jesusverse has its own schools, and it has its own museums, and it has its own amusement parks, and yes, it has its own stores. And these are stores that would never dream of carrying an officially licensed Nintendo product, right? Nintendo's of the devil. Pac-Man had ghosts in it. I know Nintendo, that's not a Nintendo game, but they didn't know that. So Wisdom Tree Games, they've got their way around the digital key lock system. They've got their retailers. Now all they need is the games. So they do a deep dive into the Bible and into modern theology, and they look for a way to truly inspire. I'm kidding. They didn't do any of that shit. They just took the games they had and they reskinned them, right? So instead of Menace Beach, now it's Sunday Fun Day. This load screen looked familiar. Perhaps the opening screen of the game will look familiar. It's the exact same game. But now instead of the gang members having kidnapped your girlfriend, they're now, I guess, the employee of the devil and trying to keep you from making it to Sunday school on time. And instead of seeing an increasingly naked girlfriend, you will see a fully clothed Sunday school teacher between the games chastising you for not making it to Sunday school on time. So, but this is what Christian video games were at the time, right? In the early 90s, they were just reskinnings of existing video games that were made with the Christian sensibilities in mind. So when Dance Dance Revolution became really popular, right, they had Dance Praise, which was the same thing, just with contemporary Christian music instead of real music. The same company would later come out with Guitar Praise. But Christian video game buyers wanted more than this. They wanted games that were Christian, not just like were scrubbed for Christians, right? But that were made for Christians. They wanted games that shared the gospel, that promoted a biblical worldview, that proselytized their faith in such a way that they could sit their kid down to play their game, and then the kid would get up more Christian. But of course, the question is, how do you do that? What would that even look like? How would you do that without the game being terrible? And this is a big enough question that no one has answered it successfully yet. But to their credit, there's a lot of things standing in the way of a good game here. And I want to talk to you about four of them. I'm in this talk by giving you four video game examples that sort of, I think, exemplify the reasons why Christian video games are so bad. So the first one is that video games are bad at reverence. right? When you're rendering things in 8 and 16-bit graphics especially, it's really hard to make them reverent. And my exemplar of this comes to us from Wisdom Tree Games. This is a game called Bible Adventures. There were actually three games on this cartridge. There was a Noah's Ark game, a Baby Moses game, and a David and Goliath game. The game I wanted to talk to you about, though, was the Baby Moses game. So in this game, you played as Baby Moses' like nursemaid or whatever. You're trying to get Baby Moses to the river so he can be sent down to be found by the Pharaoh's family and whatever. So you would carry him through these various stages. Now, there was a way, a standard way that one carried an object in video games in the late 80s, early 90s, and that was over their head like so, right? Like the vegetables in Super Mario Brothers 2. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, surely that's not how you carried a baby in the religious game Baby Moses. Yes, that is exactly how you carry him. That is not, by the way, a recommended way of carrying an infant. Don't try this at home. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, Noah, how dare you compare this to the vegetables in Super Mario Brothers 2, right? Because those you famously threw in the game, and certainly you didn't throw the Baby Moses in the Baby Moses video game. Did you? Boink. Sorry, we've got to do that again. You know, I know I could do this with a GIF or something, but I can because this way I can just savor it one frame at a time. So yeah, video games are bad at reverence. That's problem number one. Problem number two is a problem called ludonarrative dissonance. Because what's the point of knowing all these fancy phrases if you don't get a chance to use them? Ludonarrative dissonance is actually a problem that all video game makers have to deal with, right? So this is the term for the sort of inherent conflict between what the gameplay would have you do and what the story would have you do. These are very rarely the same thing, right? Because like video game stories are always like, oh, you know, the realm has fallen into darkness and only you can defeat the great wizard who has imprisoned all of the townspeople. So I'm going to need you to kill 40 foxes to upgrade your quiver, right? It just doesn't work from a storytelling perspective. Right, it's very rare in a story that's like, okay, and then you would have to go and kill 100 people again, right? But that's what the gameplay often demands. So you'll have to balance these two things out, and it makes for some really clunky devices within video games. But when you add religion to this, you've now created a three-body problem, right? Because now you have to deal with what the gameplay wants, what the story wants, and what the religion wants. And when you try to solve for that, you get things like quite possibly the worst video game ever made by anyone, the game Captain Bible in Dome of Darkness. I love this game so much. This game is the whole reason I give this talk, so I can tell people about this game. So in Captain Bible in Dome of Darkness, you play as Captain Bible, who, given his name and rank, predictably works for the Bible Corps. And the Bible Corps has discovered this city somewhere in the universe that has been trapped under a dome of darkness. And within this dome of darkness, these evil aliens have stolen everybody's Bibles. And they're now lying to those people about what the Bible says. So your mission, if you choose to accept it, is to infiltrate the dome of darkness. And then you got to go around to these various computer terminals where you can download Bible verses. You would think Captain Bible would just know his Bible verses, but no, he's got to go download them. And then along the way, he will encounter these aliens. And when you encounter an alien, the alien will tell you a cyber lie, which is very much like a regular lie. It just has the word cyber in front of it. And when the alien tells you, so like the lie might be, a holy God would never associate with an insignificant speck of protoplasm like you. And then your job is to go through all the various Bible verses that you've collected and figure out which one refutes that cyber lie. No, that's the game. That's the whole thing. So, and honestly, I don't know that I can come up with a better way of gamifying studying the Bible, right? So like hats off to these guys for trying, but that's a terrible game. So that ludonarrative dissonance, that's the second problem. Third problem, right, is that a big part of what makes video games fun is the role-playing aspect. And biblical role-play is no fun. Okay, some forms of biblical role-play can be fun. Wait, sorry, wrong slide. Here we go. Biblical role-play is no fun, right? So I have a great example of the problem that this creates because it's a really apples-to-apples comparison. So we have to start off with a game that's actually phenomenal, right? A game called Castle Wolfenstein 3D. This is the game that most people would agree is the grandfather of the first-person shooter genre, It's a very popular genre, the second most popular genre in the world at this point. And it really all started with Castle Wolfenstein 3D. You can argue that other games may have been first-person shooters before this, but this is the game that popularized it, right? But the company that made this would go on a year later to make a much better first-person shooter in there. And this is a rabbit hole that I really have to, I read like three books about this, so I have to really stop myself from running down that rabbit hole. But the point for this talk is that a couple of years after this game was antiquated by better systems, along comes Wisdom Tree Games, and they said, hey, can we license the engine for Castle Wolfenstein 3D and remake it as a Christian game? Well, the company that made Castle Wolfenstein 3D, they have no use for this antiquated system, so they're like, sure, knock yourself out. So they come out with a game called Super Noah's Ark 3D. This would be the only unlicensed game ever released for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, the Gen 4 console. So now what they've done is they've taken the exact same game and they've just changed the graphics, right? So instead of there being pictures of Hitler on the wall, we're to believe that Noah went around and had pictures of himself commissioned, I guess, to hang all over the ark. And instead of running around shooting at Nazis, you've got all these animals that are acting up during the flood. And of course, you're not shooting them, right? Because you can't have that kind of violence in a Christian game. A pin in that. So instead, you've got a slingshot that's loaded with magical food pellets. And apparently Noah's a crack shot. He can shoot right down the mouth of a raging bear with his feed pellets, forcing him to eat the feed pellets. And then when the animal eats the feed pellet, they fall asleep. So it's the same game as Castle Wolfenstein 3D, which is a fantastic game. The only difference is instead of running around a castle shooting Nazis, you're running around an ark roofying goats. You see how something's lost in translation here? So, and sorry, this is from a part of the talk that I had to take out. But we have a fourth problem that we wanted to talk about, which is the fact that even if you can get all those other three things right, Christianity is still awful. Right? So even if you can nail everything else, you're still stuck with a religion that is a terrible thing to base a game on. And that leads us to the penultimate game that I want to talk to you about today. That's a game called Left Behind Eternal Forces. This was released in 2006. It was based on the very popular, at least in the United States, novel series Left Behind by Tim LaHaye. And I want to show you that the cover for that game one more time, because I want to draw your attention to the blurbs here. The first one, the one on the left from the LA Times, says Eternal Forces looks and plays like a big budget production. It's just like a real video game. That's Damned by Faint Praise. And speaking of Damned by Faint Praise, the one on the right, this is from Breakaway Magazine. That's Focus on the Family, right? So this is a very, very Christian publication. And the best they could come up with to say is worth your time and money. So Left Behind Eternal Forces is what's called a real-time strategy game. This is a type of game where you control one army and you're playing against other armies, and it's sort of like a real-time chess thing going on, right? And in this game, you control the scrappy Christians that are fighting against Nikolai Carpathia, the Antichrist and his forces, and the forces of the heretics, right? But I want to be clear that what distinguishes these three armies, right, is that your army is Christian, Nikolai Carpathia's army is atheist, and the heretic army is Muslim. And the game is won by forcing the other two armies to adopt your religion, whether by violence or otherwise. That's the game. Also, the Crusades, right? Both of them had the same plot. So needless to say, when this game comes out, it generates quite a bit of controversy all over the world. It's pulled from store shelves almost immediately. But here's the point I wanted to make about this. I know I'm running a little bit long here, so I'm going to hurry through this last bit. But the point I want to make here, right? So we don't know exactly how much it costs to make Left Behind Eternal Forces. We can estimate, though, given the size of the game and the size of the team that worked on it, how long they worked on it, we can estimate that it was between $3 and $5 million. We know pretty much exactly how the free market valued the game. The game made $2 million. I'm no mathematician, but that looks like a loss of $1 to $3 million on the project. And yet, the game had a part two and a part three. And as you've no doubt guessed, based on the orientation of this graphic, a part four. Why? How? How can a game that lost $1 to $3 million keep getting sequels? And the sequels, by the way, did not do significantly better. How does this happen? What happens because that $3 to $5 million, that's only a loss to the person producing the game, not to the person making the game. This is not raw material cost, right? They didn't go down to the binary mines and get a bunch of ones and zeros. This is the money that was paid to the developers. So the developers didn't lose all this money, right? They made $3 to $5 million off of whoever they got to produce their games. Normally, a game company has to use the profits from game one to pay for game two's production, right? But for a Christian video game maker, all they have to do is convince a church group or a Christian philanthropist that their kid would love Jesus as much as they love Minecraft if only Jesus had a video game. Now, this was back in 2006, 2008, 2010, when these games were coming out, right? Back when you had to find a group with a fairly large sum of money if you wanted to raise $3 to $5 million. But nowadays, we have crowdsourcing, which leads us to the last game I want to talk to you about. This is a game called I Am Jesus Christ. We're now talking about the future of Christian video games. This one's not out yet, but it promises to be a first-person Messiah simulator, in which you as Jesus can get baptized, perform miracles, use your carpentry skills to craft new items. I swear I'm not just making that shit up. That's really in the advertisement for it. And of course, defeat Satan, because that's the whole point. Now this game, this I Am Jesus game, it's not out yet. The release date has been postponed a couple of times and now is just indefinite. But they're still taking money. You can still support it on Kickstarter. Now, I want to be clear here. I understand UK libel laws enough to know that I can't, I'm not going to close my talk by accusing anybody of a grift or anything like that. So I won't need any of these other slides at the end of the talk. I'm done now.
Welcome. And now, straight into questions. Melanie asks, when you decide you'd prefer riches over ethics, what game will you convert to a lame Christian version?
Maybe Tetris, right? There's underutilized cross potential in Tetris. So.
Yeah, but it's the only shape.
Yeah, you get a tessellation going there pretty soon. I don't know. I have to give that some thought, but I love it, Melanie. I like to keep my options open.
Good. Completely different take. Igor, by the way, the Igor drinking game is in play. You know what you have to do. Igor asks, are Christians unique in their approach to gaming? Super Buddha Brothers 3000 isn't a thing.
Yeah, so, I've looked into that quite a bit. I have not managed to find, I've managed to find a few games that are designed for Jewish children to learn about their religion, but they're like trivia games, right? They're not like disguising themselves as action games. I haven't found anything like the Christian video game industry for any other religion, though.
Okay, question from Anonymous. Have you played any of these games? And if so, which was your favorite or the worst ever?
So I have played all the games that are in the talk, except for the Music Machine and Red Sea Crossing. I did play a version of Music Machine online one time, but I didn't play it with like the Atari controller and everything. And I would say Captain Bible in the Dome of Darkness was definitely the worst. Genuinely, it is impossible to have fun, no matter how. Like, it's because I love consuming the terrible stuff, right? I love that aspect of it. Even then, you just cannot have fun playing that game.
That's the one where you collect the Bible verses.
Yes.
Okay. It somehow reminds me of the famous fencing in Monkey Island. Monkey Island. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Good. Now, you showed us the slide. There's a question to it. Anonymous asks, can you explain the He Gets Us slide?
I'd love to. I honestly, genuinely don't remember. I accidentally gave these guys the wrong set of slides for an earlier version of this talk, and I genuinely don't remember what gag that was for. So, oh, you know what? Now I do. I do remember it. I was because I was making the point. The reason I left it out is because I didn't remember it, and I just did. The reason was that I was making a point about how, you know, if you can convince a rich Christian to give you money, there's no end of what kind of marketing bullshit you can get away with. And I think that was my example of that. So now that I remember, I'll work it back into the talk.
Okay. Question from Cat H. Does this stuff have much of a market outside the USA?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I know that the Nintendo Entertainment System and derivatives of it or clones of it were very popular in South America, but I think the Christian video game, like sort of the impetus to play and have these games is a far more Protestant than Catholic concept. I think it fits more into their theology, or certainly that type of proselytization fits more into their theology. So I don't think it's really picked up in many other places. I'm not aware of a market for it anywhere else, except for as like, you know, a subset of whatever weird Christian stuff we export.
Yeah. Another question from Igor. For some reason, I see way less 1 million mom groups freaking out over Catholic imagery in Cyberpunk 2077 or devil imagery in Baldur's Gate. Did they give up?
That's interesting, right? Because they did get mad about, oh, hell, what which one was it? It was something, Diablo 4. They got mad about that one. So I think there might be a degree to which they just lost. Right, that this is a war that they know that they've already lost, and there are so many games that have, you know, sacrilegious imagery or imagery that would piss them off that they know they can't really attack them. But I think a certain amount of it, again, not to go too far down another rabbit hole, but a certain amount of it is that they've seen the backfire effect on this, right? So in America, we have a thing called the ESRB, which is the Entertainment Safety Ratings Bureau, I think. But it's the system that rates video games, and it's an industry system. It's not enforced by the government, but it was something that the industry picked up because Congress was sort of threatening to enforce a standard on video games. So they made this rating system at the demand of these Christians that were pissed off about the level of violence in video games. This was the level of violence in Nintendo games, right? But primarily, so a very low level of violence. What happened is they created this rating system. And now they have a rating that is MA. It's mature. And it's like, well, now that can have nudity and it can have sex and it can have profanity and it can have no end of violence. And what they realized is by sort of forcing this issue and making the video game industry create a rating system, they allowed the video game industry to step away from the, you know, very comic book code level of ethics that they had been enforcing up to that point. So I think that it may just be some amount of that, them recognizing that it's so easy for this to backfire.
Hmm. We have a question from Paul, also known as Picticule. Do you have any examples of Islamic video games? How many infidels can you kill in a given time?
No, it seems like there's a lot of potential there. But no, like I said, outside of some trivia games to help you learn, Jewish rituals and prayers and whatnot, I haven't found any video games that are, you know, specifically aimed at a religion other than Christianity.
Okay. Somehow that performance aspect keeps coming back. Melanie asks, how many goats per minute can you roofie on Noah's Ark?
So the thing of that's really funny about this is that I actually never played Castle Wolfenstein 3D. I know it only by reputation. And so my first experience with that game system was playing Super Noah's Ark 3D, and I enjoyed the shit out of it, right? Because it's a great game underneath all of that nonsense. But one of the worst things about the game is that, or worst things about the game, but one of the real limitations is that they could only have, like, I think 6 different animals in it, right? Yeah. So, like, rather than all the zoo that you would expect in Noah's Ark, it's just like, well, yeah, he carried, you know, 2 of the clean, 7 of the unclean, and 457 bears, you know, or whatever. So I don't know my goats roofing per minute. statistic. Believe it or not, this is the first time I've been asked.
Okay. A type of game that didn't come up in your talk is text-only adventure games. Mm-hmm. So Paul asks, what about those? These would appear to be ideal vehicles for getting kids to engage with Bible stories.
Yeah, well, so I do believe there's probably a lot of examples of that that fall into that black hole, that 1977 to 1984 or so black hole of PC gaming. Especially because like even games that had large audiences, if you were in PC gaming at the time, you'll recall that the piracy scene was rampant back then, right? Like everybody was sharing pirated games at that point. And that's really how games perpetuated in the market back then, more than through sales. And so the only ones of those text games generally, like there's a couple of them that, you know, like Zork and stuff that were really big, that we still have like the source code for, but the only ones of those that we really have record of, other than those big few, are the ones that were popular enough to be shared over and over and pirated over and over again. And I just don't think that the Christian games made it into there. Now there probably are a great deal of modern text-based adventures that are Christian in nature. There's just none that have ever risen to the level that I've been aware of them.
And I guess those text-based adventures were more PC stuff than console.
Yeah, you'll see them on console now. There's sort of a retro reimagining of the genre now, but yeah, it was very much a PC thing back then.
Yeah. Another question from Anonymous. What's your favorite part of your current personal collection? What is your dream item that you don't yet have?
There was a Russian copy of the Nintendo Entertainment System called the Dendy, I think D-E-N-D-Y. And I would love to get a copy of that and some of the games for that, and a TV it would play on or some way to convert that. So that I think would be my dream item. Of the items that I have now, I have a nearly complete set of the original Magnavox Odyssey. If you know anything at all about this is so early in video game history that it really couldn't play many games. So when it was sold with like a bunch of board game equipment and fake money and cards for different games. And there were these clings that you would have to put, they didn't have graphics. So you would use static electricity to cling a little plastic thing to your TV screen that would provide the bulk of the graphics. And so it's almost impossible to get all of the different pieces that came with that. I've never seen a full set for sale anywhere. And so I've been slowly piecing together what I can. And I've got a nearly full set of the original Magnavox Odyssey at this point.
Never heard of this, but good. Nadia is asking a question. Why is the symbolism that is okay in Christian art, crosses, skulls, and so on, considered mockery in games? Is there any line or logic for that?
Right. So that's a great question, and one that I didn't probably express enough in the talk. So there's two answers to that question, right? One is that video games, sort of just because of a prejudice that I did touch on a little bit in the talk, are seen as kids stuff, right? So anytime Christian imagery makes its way into it, it's seen as just a little bit low. That's less a problem now, right? It was more of a problem in the 80s and 90s. But the real answer to that is that it's not like there was sort of a blanket prohibition against this. It's that Nintendo enforced a blanket prohibition against it because they were unable to parse out what was blasphemous and what was reverent, right? I think there was always a way that you could use that symbolism within video games that would have made Christians happy. But I think it would have been very difficult to tease out if you weren't super familiar with the the culture, and the number of ways it could go wrong and the extent to which it could go wrong made it so that it was far easier just to exclude it altogether. To understand this too, you have to keep in mind that there was still a lot of post-World War II prejudice against the Japanese in America at that time. And there was a big fear that the Japanese were buying up all of the American companies back then. There's a lot of xenophobia of that. I believe there was a time when Nintendo had been taken to task by an American company for monopolistic practices. So Congress decided to hold a hearing about it on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. There was a lot that Nintendo had to fight against in terms of American prejudice. And I just think that their fear of overstepping or stepping in the wrong direction on religion was just pervasive, right? It was just all encompassing for them.
Okay. We got a question from Tyler. Do you have any thoughts on how the producers of Trek like this are also significant to the history of copyright circumvention and video game preservation?
Sorry, I missed a little bit of that question. The word Drek, I'm not what I hear all the time. I think it's actually, I don't know enough about digital rights management to really comment on that heavily. But absolutely, companies like Color Dreams and their subsidiary Wisdom Tree Games were absolutely movers and shakers in that space, and probably have echoes that still resonate today in today's understanding of that whole field of law. The Nest 10 lockout chip is seen by a lot of people as sort of the birthplace of digital rights management in terms of our modern understanding of it. So I would say certainly, but I'm not qualified to really say what that place was.
I wanted to ask that surge that those cartridges created, did they disable the chip permanently or only temporarily until the next reboot?
No, it would disable it temporarily, and it wouldn't even consistently do that. It also could damage the system. And so like I would never put a Color Dreams game or a Wisdom Tree game into one of my vintage consoles, right? Because of that, just because it's dangerous to the equipment. But it mostly worked. When they did the Super Nintendo one, the Super NOS Arc 3D, what they did, and a couple of companies in Australia had already figured this out as a way of circumventing the NES lockout chip, was that they would make the cartridges such that you would insert the cartridge into the system, and then you would insert another cartridge that was approved by Nintendo into the first cartridge. And the game would just the system would just like piggyback the key that was in the other cartridge and allow it to circumvent the system that way. So I thought that was kind of fun.
Time for a shot. Igor asks, when games went popular, what came first? The newest, greatest Christian freak out or the regular kids these days moral panic?
So yeah, I think it's really hard to tease that out in American culture, like which is which.
Too close hand in hand, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think that video games, like I said, for the reasons I outlined, were sort of uniquely scary to people because they had so many negative associations sort of all right away. So I do think it probably was a lot more of just the kids these days, because think about the contrast of standing in a more or less dark room looking at a computer screen versus baseball, right? Which is what people, when parents look at kids these days, they're comparing them to kids when they were kids. And the contrast in what they were doing was so great that, I can see a lot of that being sort of the driving force of the Christian freak out.
Mm, yeah, true. Question from Awesome. Aren't a lot of these games committing the sins of blasphemy or idolatry and so breaking their own belief systems?
Absolutely, right? And so there is like a Christian freak out about the Christian games as well. There are a couple of, the Left Behind Eternal Forces that we talked about. A lot of Christian groups were just as up in arms about that as atheist groups were. There was also, and I don't remember the name of it now, but there's a game that really heavily relied on Catholic imagery, and it was supposed to be a sort of pro-Catholic, from a Catholic perspective game, mm-hmm. but it got so deep into the lore that Catholics were offended by it. There's a point where you get into their mythology deep enough and they don't want to confront the fact that actually is their mythology.
Okay.
Some of that as well.
Let's see. Question from David. Related, are there any religious board games, and have you any experience of any?
Yes, there are definitely religious board games. We get sent those from time to time. So every year, when there's not a global pandemic, my coworkers and I all get together and we rent a house and we have we spend a week together because we're a company where everybody lives in a different state. So it's just, it's valuable to all get together. And when we do that, we do a live stream for our financial supporters. During that live stream, very often we'll play board games that we like and stuff like that. And so people will send us Christian board games from time to time to play during those. And most of those that I've seen are trivia games, right? So Bible trivia is the sort of at the heart of them. I am aware of some other games where, the objective is to make your way through heaven in the game Life. But I haven't played anything that wasn't just biblical trivia.
What would be at the end of a game of heaven? The next stage?
Okay. That's a great question. Yeah, I guess you just have to play that one for eternity.
Go back to start. Yeah. Okay, question from Igor. Do Christians still believe D&D is a devil's tool of evilness?
Yeah, well, so I think there's a certain extent, and Igor touched on this with his question, to which anything that is novel is far scarier, right? Yeah. Because, yes, there are definitely people who still believe that, right? But there are also tabletop role-playing games that are Christian, that are explicitly Christian, and that where your job is to save souls from Satan and things like that. So, it's certainly not monolithic, but there are definitely especially in the region of the country I'm in the deep South, there are definitely Christians who still think of D&D as satanic. I have members of my wife's family who think that.
Okay. Better don't tell them about D&D minus them.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Well, whenever anybody asks me what I do for a living in this area, I'm walking on eggshells already. I don't think D&D minus is the one that's going to piss him off the most.
True. Movie reviewer. Yeah. Question from Anonymous. Are there any ROMs of these games? He'd love to play that Devil Hunter game that never got released in the US.
Oh, Devil's World, you could absolutely play. Nintendo is really, really litigious when it comes to any unauthorized reproduction of their games, so you might have trouble finding it online. I have a Famicom version of it, and there was a version of the NES that was released that played Famicom games as well that was later in the release. I think it was called the NES 101. And I have that. So I play the original Famicom cartridge on it, but you can absolutely still find that game. The other games I talk about are far easier to find, right? A lot of those are from companies that no longer exist. Wisdom Tree Games is still around. They'll still sell you the ROMs for those. But most of those games are fairly easy to find. There's nobody really actively hawking, watching those copyrights. Yeah. The Nintendo game specifically, though, is going to be a little bit tougher. But it is worth tracking down. It's a fantastic game. It's an absolute gem.
Okay. Question from Carla. Do you have a list of all the Christian games with the systems they released on?
I do not.
Or is it just in your head?
Yeah, it's just the one. There are definitely a lot of them that I'm not aware of, so...
Okay. Jin Okami 428 asks, are you all ever going to talk about the Christian themes in JRPGs, for example, Xenosaga? That's a very detailed question.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that game. JRPGs have never been my favorite genre of game, so there's a lot of even the more popular ones that I haven't played, but you do find a lot of Christian themes in sort of like the Japanese interpretation of Christian themes in video games in all sorts of video games now, which I find very interesting. Sort of it's more of a caricature than a portrait, or more of a portrait than a mirror, and I find that very interesting. But I don't. I'm not really knowledgeable enough about it to speak on it.
Okay, now there's something you might start hunting for. Anonymous asks: have you heard of a game called Timothy and Titus from White Knight Games in Perth, Australia? Only game they ever made, as far as the questioner knows.
I am not aware of this game. No. I'll have to look it up.
Bad. So there is a point two to this talk.
Right, yeah, right. I do know that Australian game makers were sort of the world leaders in finding their way around that Nest 10 lockout chip that we were talking about. They were the first companies that started doing the sort of piggybacking thing and stuff like that. So I'm not surprised that there's maybe some Christian games from that era, some great, you know, some terrible Christian games from that era that come out of Australia.
Hey, Asur asks, billionaire money, what would PIAT Christian game look like?
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so I think that you could make a really fun atheist game using Bible stories, right? But just not the Bible story. Like, you know, you have to collect 1,000 Philistine foreskins as a side quest kind of a thing, right? Or you know, you have to, like, deliver the parts of the concubine to the four corners of the kingdom. Or, you know, there's a lot of terrible, awful Christian stories that just telling Christians, hey, this is in your Bible too, really gives them a nudge in the atheist direction. So I think you can make a great game out of that.
Okay. Another anonymous question. Is there any Christian story or idea that you can imagine working as a game?
Absolutely. I think you could make a really fun game out of the story of David. You know, not just David and Goliath, but just the larger story of King David. I think you could make a really interesting RPG style game out of that. I think that a lot of people would consider it sacrilegious if you did, right? Which is why nobody would, especially because David is such a flawed character, right? So you know, you've got him, you know, sending Bathsheba's husband off to die and peeking on her in the bath and all this stuff. So I do think that story has, you know, there's a point in that story where he has to, like, go back and get Goliath's sword to go forward. It's like there are parts of that story that just seem almost made for a video game. But like I said, you know, if there are interesting stories, stories within the Bible that would make interesting video games, Christians are not interested in telling those stories.
Okay. How much do the Christian games tend to sell? Anonymous asks. Is this a big market?
No. So the key that you have to understand here is that the market is not the player. It is the person producing the game, right? That's not universally true. There are definitely some games out there that are just genuinely trying to do the Christian thing, whatever. But a lot of the games that we're talking about are games that are made by people who aren't Christian or who are just exploiting Christians, or maybe they are Christian, right? But they're just exploiting Christians who are willing to pay for the game to be created, right? So if you look at the games that we talked about throughout this entire talk, virtually none of them are games that were even designed for the game player to look at and say, I want to play that.
Yeah.
Right? The Red Sea Crossing, that was designed for, you know, there's not a video game playing kids reading Christianity Today magazine. That was for grandma to see and say, oh, look, it's one of those Atari games like Timmy likes, and disappoint him with that as a okay. birthday present, right?
Yeah. Only three questions left. Igor asks, did you hear about the woke ranking for video games?
No.
Do you think those guys are legit or no? Question is gone. No is good enough.
That's just amazing. I'm sorry. I'll have to look that up.
Crafty has got a question for us. This was an excellent talk. Are you going to help Eli write one for God Awful Comics now?
Oh, that could be fun. Yeah, that's something that we really haven't explored much. I have another talk that I do on the history of Christian movies. But yeah, comics is not something that we've really looked into. I'll have to pass that along to Eli. That's a great idea. Thank you.
And final question from Igor. Last drink of the night, everyone. Last call. Does Christoverse still trying to make it into the gaming world, or did they finally give up?
So that's a great question. And that allows me to sort of, like, cap off the main point that I want to make with the talk, right? Which is that, like I said, the goal of the a lot of people in the Christian video game industry is not to sell a popular game. It is to fund an expensive game. And that they can do. The reason we hear less about it is because it's more often now being done through crowdsourcing. So it's not like, you know, people aren't investing millions of dollars in it or anything like that. So, you know, listen, I'll be careful what exactly I accuse anyone of doing or anything. But I do think that that's like, it's still there. The games are still there. But the amount of audience they need to reach is much, much smaller these days in order to, like, you know, in order to justify their existence.
Good. That's it. I think we're at the end of the questions. Thank you very much, Noah. I think I wouldn't say we learned anything, but it was definitely interesting. All that leaves me is to thank the technicians in the background, David and Igor. Thank you. And my charming assistant / understudy, Kat Ford. Noah, the biggest thank of all belongs to you. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day. Really enjoyed it. And to everybody else on the call, as usual, stay safe, stay healthy, stay skeptical. Bye.
Thanks.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow @SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.